For almost 2,000 years, the Catholic Church has pointed the way toward salvation through Jesus Christ. For each of us, that journey starts in darkness, as if in a cave. We invite you now to come with us as we seek wisdom and truth by way of faith and reason with your guides, Mark Tuttle and Timothy O'Donnell. Join us in the Catholic Cave. Welcome once again to the Catholic Cave. I'm Kent Blanford. In the cave with me, Mr. Mark Tuttle, Mr. Timothy O'Donnell. Guys, I got a jury duty summons this week.
Uh-oh.
You know, the thing that everyone dreads. And, you know, it's one of those things. I know I have a civic duty, and I also have a responsibility as a Catholic to carry my beliefs with me everywhere I go. How do those two work together?
Well, I think you have an obligation to take them up on their free lunch because that's worth it, right?
Just isn't that a paid day off for you too, Kent?
Yep, just going down there to just run down there to get your free lunch. That's
focus on that.
No, the jury system is a it's a wonderful American institution. You know, it's something that's part of our responsibility as citizens of the United States to participate in it. So, you know, it's not something to, I think, completely blow off. I think there's the...
Well, the joke I think there are penalties if you do blow it off.
Yeah, hey, there's penalties.
You got to play along, yeah.
But no, I think, you know, the running joke is, you know, a jury is a jury of your peers who are not smart enough to get out of it.
Well, it's an interesting way for us to maybe introduce our listeners this during this program and how we're going to take a look at maybe citizenship and what it means to be a citizen. And maybe more, and with that, of course, I think we're going to bring up the topic of, you know, church and state, and maybe look at a little bit of the history behind that. And here, of course, we, in America, we pride ourselves on having a separation of church and state. But Mark, don't you think that's pretty misunderstood, or there are a variety of different constituencies in America that when you say separation of church and state, have very different ideas on what that means.
Right. And I think particularly here in the Catholic Cave, talking about this topic's important because, you know, throughout American history, there's been this stereotype that Catholics set themselves apart from the state. That, I think when John F. Kennedy was running for president, there was the accusation, well, you know, Catholics answer to Rome first and to, you know, their country second, and that, you know, our allegiance is to church, and therefore that somehow diminishes our allegiance to state. So I think, you know, kind of talking about what's the relationship as a Catholic to our faith and how we follow the rules and teachings of the church versus how we follow the laws and what we ought to do when those sometimes conflict, how we as Catholics need to address that, and you know, what's our role and responsibility there.
Yep. So let's begin with this whole notion of church and state. So if we sort of roll back the clock, you know, several centuries, we have in the West a historical setting in which I'm going to go all the way back to Christendom, where we have sort of a pre-nation state setting, say across Europe, where the church, Holy Mother Church, and I'm going to take us back before the Reformation, say back to the time of Aquinas, right? St. Thomas Aquinas and St. Bonaventure run around. So here in the maybe, you know, 12th century, 13th century, we have a setting in which you have more of an empire. You have an aristocracy. You have nobility. You have a kind of a peasantry, if you will. But you also have, there is no, as we would understand, separation of church and state, in that everyone, there's only one church. First of all, it's the Catholic Church. So they're right there. You have a kind of setting in which there's the Catholic Church, but living within Christendom, you also have, though, well, you have Jews, you have some Muslims, Zoroastrians, you have others that are not Christian or not Catholic at the time, but you don't have a kind of, but you don't really have a secular society as we would understand it today. That's my understanding or my reading of it.
Yeah, I think, you know, there's a lot of, I guess you could say, equivocation around what is meant by separation of church and state based on what do you mean by church? And I mean, what institution are you really talking about? Are you talking about a state-run church where, you know, those that are part of this kingdom are following the religion of the prince? And so, you know, that's an established church within that realm. Or are you talking about the interplay between the ecclesial bodies and the, you know, what was playing as government bodies? So, you know, the church had a role in being sort of the court system for medieval Europe, for instance. So, you know, the laws were more or less church laws, even though you kind of had the king as the one that was sort of implementing the laws, etc. But, you know, when you look at separation of church and state and you contrast what was going on in Europe with Christianity versus what was going on in other areas of the world, you know, you contrast what was going on with Islam in the Middle East. You look at China, India, the idea of the church and the monarch being separate is a very Western idea, and it's very kind of unique to Western Europe and the tradition that we came out of. And, you know, that you got to go back to, like, you know, the 8th century and looking at the coronation of Charlemagne. So, you know, France, to a certain extent, was the first, I guess you could say, nation state. So, you know, the Franks were this Germanic tribe that had come in, had taken over what was previously Gaul, and, you know, the Romans had kind of taken over Gaul. And so as the Roman Empire was crumbling, the Franks kind of took dominion over this, and they converted to Christianity. And when they converted to Christianity, they sought out the sanction of the church to be proclaimed monarchs. So there was the Pope himself went, and he was the one that proclaimed Charlemagne as the king. And so there was a tacit understanding right there that, first off, the church and the kingship were two separate things. Second of all, the authority that was bestowed on the king was bestowed by the church. And so you had a relationship of two separate entities and a recognition that they were separate, but that they were intertwined and related to each other, kind of right there from kind of the beginning of Western Europe and Western Europe, I guess Western European culture.
Yeah, that's a great point. I mean, thinking about what is a coronation? A coronation, right? It's a religious ceremony, right?
Yeah, exactly.
That's how it was always understood, and it's still performed that way today, say in England. So where one receives that, you know, I will jump ahead just a little bit, just because it's interesting trivia. You know who broke that tradition was Napoleon.
Right.
Napoleon crowns himself.
Exactly. After
part of his project, though, was to get rid of a crown and throne. And then he marches across Europe, you know, conquering and just, you know, getting rid of monarchs and kicking the Catholic Church out wherever he could, captures the Pope. And then finally he decides he wants to be emperor. And then, of course, they finally acquiesce. They have the coronation ceremony. But at the last second, he pulls the crown out of, I think it was the Pope's hands, and crowns himself, you know, which says it all.
Right.
You know, says it all you need to know about Napoleon.
But I think people forget that with that act, he was rebelling against a long tradition within Western tradition of, you know, the church kind of being there as sort of an overseer of the monarchies. And, you know, the church was the entity really that kind of laid out the laws. The church played the role of judge, whether it was through, you know, a system of cathedrals and the local bishop, or whether it was through monasteries, or whether it was later through the use of the mendicant orders, the Dominicans and Jesuits as, you know, inquisitors, which that's got a whole nother history.
right.
And, you know, we should probably unpack that at some point. But, yeah, the Inquisition was not the evil institution that it's often kind of portrayed to be, although there were abuses and things that went on that led to evil.
Anytime there's people involved, there's
right.
bound to be.
But
you're bound to find sin. But yeah, Inquisition's much more like a grand jury.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It was kind of a traveling court system that, yeah. that moved from place to place to be able to hold court and try people convicted of not religious crimes necessarily, but just crimes in general. So the church had a definite role. The king had a definite role within society, and they were separate. And the whole idea of the separation between the religious practices that were being advocated and then the role of civic government very much from the get-go are two separate sets of institutions within our tradition as Westerners.
Right. And I think it's also understood too, it's not exclusively this, but I like to think of like the the king or queen, ruling, having more temporal power and authority, that's subject to, though, the spiritual authority of the church. And I think that's where, when I think about the interplay between church and state, that's where I think we see a very useful model, which is that you have examples throughout. Think of like St. Thomas Becket. St. Thomas Becket, who is what? He's a good friend. First he's the good friend of what will eventually be King Henry II of England. And eventually Thomas Becket becomes what? He becomes an archdeacon, but from archdeacon he becomes what? The Archbishop of Canterbury, right? Which is the highest ecclesial office in that part of the world. And has a really profound conversion too upon assuming that office, and he calls his good friend the king to account when the king is abuses his power, or the king is doing things that are violations of what? Faith and morals,
right?
Because that is the sphere of which holy, and still is today, the sphere in which we need to look at Holy Mother Church. And this is why, as a preview, this is, you see in St. Thomas Becket, he calls the king to account. The king doesn't like it, and actually causes him to be exiled. St. Thomas Becket is exiled to France for something like 7 years or so. Finally, there's a reconciliation upon his return to England. He's not there very long, again, holding the king and his court to account. And eventually, St. Thomas Becket is murdered by the king's henchmen on the steps of his cathedral.
Yeah.
And then the last interesting part of that, I mean, there's a lot to that story, but the thing that happened is, upon the overwhelming response by the lay people and Holy Mother Church to the slaughter of this good and holy man, Thomas Becket, is that the king does public penance at his gravesite. So at St. Thomas Becket's gravesite, King Henry is stripped and scourged at the tomb of the man that they had murdered. And you can't imagine today with politicians with their accountability, but let me pause. We got to take a break. But just imagine if the church were able to call and people were able to respond, that when they went off track, hey, they were going to be held accountable.
Well, in some cases, it's not always good to be the king. We're going to take a break and we'll be right back. More of the Catholic Cave right after this.
Think of all the media our young people are exposed to today. MTV, movies, what passes for entertainment on TV, song lyrics that are questionable or worse. Where do they hear the message that it's okay to be chaste and modest, or that it's not crazy to practice their faith, or to believe in a God who loves them and can forgive them no matter what they do? Catholic Radio is the answer. Be sure to tell your friends and relatives about Catholic Radio Indy.
Hello, ladies. I want to invite you all to the 13th Annual Indiana Catholic Women's Conference. This year it is to be held at the Indiana Convention Center in the 500 Ballroom. The date is March the 10th and includes a great lineup of national and international speakers. For more information, you can go online at indianacatholicwomen.com. www.thecatholiccatholic.com or call 317-888-0873. See you there.
Welcome back to the Catholic Cave. I'm Mark Tuttle here with Timothy O'Donnell, Kent Blandford, and we are talking about civics today. We are talking about our relationship as Catholics to, you know, the state, to government, to, you know, to the civic life of the communities that we live in. We were talking before the break about the notion of a separation between church and state. And the notion we were talking about is a little bit of a different one than I think most people have in their mind when you talk about separation of church and state. When people talk about separation of church and state, they think of, I think, the Enlightenment idea that the established church of whatever entity you're talking about ought to be something completely independent of the government, and there should be no established church.
And actually no contact
between the two. Exactly. Correct. So the religious life of the people should be something that they decide for themselves, that they choose, that they engage in independently of really any civic institution. And that's been kind of a growing, I think, sphere where the separation, it used to be, you know, it's basically the federal government wasn't going to establish a religion. And then that has gradually changed to there should be no real religious life that intertwines with civic life.
Yeah, it should be eradicated, which is why you see these outrageous lawsuits from time to time about, you know, removing. There's been a cross, for example, that's been on federal grounds for 120 years as a memorial to, one or more persons who have died, and all of a sudden, you know, there's someone will bring a lawsuit that says, well, that violates the presence of the cross on federal ground constitutes a violation of the principle of church and state, because it seems as if the federal government is sanctioning a religion, i.e. Christianity, because it's a cross. That's a violation of the clause of the separation. So we need to, there's nothing in the Constitution or Declaration of Independence that says there is a separation of church and state. There is, within the Bill of Rights, we have a clause about not establishing a state religion. In the same clause, we also have the freedom to exercise religion. And this is where things have gotten really muddy in the current setting.
Well, in the current setting, it seems like we've gone from freedom of religion to a movement of freedom from religion.
Right. Yeah. The movement.
Exactly.
The movement
that's the mistake.
Yeah. And it's been to try to expunge religious life from civic life completely. You know, the clause within the Bill of Rights was an establishment clause. So it was against the idea that the federal government was going to establish a religion. And believe it or not,
Presbyterian.
Right.
Like.
But a lot of the states still had established religions.
Correct.
You know, Virginia was still Anglican.
Yeah.
The Puritan churches were still the established religion of Massachusetts, and that continued for another 20-30 years, and gradually then the states realized that, you know, well, we shouldn't be establishing religion either, but it was still left to municipalities, etc., to have a more or less established religion within the way they did things. Mm-hmm. And that gradually has come under fire. And you go back to even I think as recent as the 1950s, 1960s, where we had Christian prayers in public schools. You know, we had things that were still, I think, vestiges of this idea that religion played a part of civic life, and it played a part of the life that we live as citizens. That sphere where religious life is allowed to affect things has been encroached upon over time. We were talking before the break about a different model of separation of church and state, though. We were talking about, I think, as you put it, the realm of temporal sovereignty versus the realm of spiritual sovereignty, and how in the West it's sort of a unique situation that those have always been seen as two separate spheres. You look at Islam, it's one and the same. You know, the those who rule are also those who are the spiritual leaders. You look to the East, you look to Hinduism, Buddhism to a certain extent. The waters are much more muddy in those cultures, definitely, as far as what is considered spiritual and what is considered temporal. The West, kind of part of the genius of the West, is that we've had this separation between the temporal and the spiritual really from our founding, you know, coming out of the crumbling of the Roman Empire. You brought up Thomas a Becket, St. Thomas a Becket, and King Henry II as sort of a model, I think, between the relationship between that. And Thomas a Becket, as the Archbishop of Canterbury, had a certain amount of, I think, oversight of what the king was doing. So it was the role of the church to come in and say, these laws are in accordance with God's laws. These laws are in accordance with the divine laws. Or not. You know, you get correct to Thomas More
right
and King Henry VIII, and you see, you know, Thomas More basically advising the king as sort of the spokesperson for the church at the time, that no, what you are doing is in no way representative of God's laws, and it's a violation of God's laws, and therefore it ought not be permitted within the state.
That's exactly right.
And that situation, to a certain extent, still pertains, but our understanding of sovereignty has changed. Rather than us seeing, you know, the king as sovereign, we now see the populace as sovereign within the United States.
Yeah, I think a couple of things that make so I'm you're drawing me to the idea of the topic of moral authority,
right?
And the moral authority of the church, and historically in the West, Holy Mother Church is the source of moral authority because of her teachings. And so her teachings, but also the credibility of the saints. She's a saint factory. So you can think of, like, again, historically, you can think of St. Bernard of Clairvaux as another one. But you can have you have your moral authority in the United States. Here's where the Catholic Church struggles to exercise moral authority, because for one of the main differences would be the population is, what, 20% Catholic only? So right there, 80% of the citizens of the United States are not Catholic, so they're not inclined to necessarily listen to Holy Mother Church, which would be very different than, say, even at the time of, say, Henry VIII, his realm is auspiciously Catholic, right? I mean, that's how adherent they all are is a different matter, but it's a Catholic monarchy, right? And so there, you have that aspect of it. But I also think when it comes to in the current setting where the church has difficulty with moral authority is there's a kind of historical revisionism that's happened where religion, whether Catholic or Christianity in particular, I would say, in all of its various denominations, but then of course the Catholic Church as well, is caught up in this, you know, Christianity is not held up in a lot of circles as a light, as a bearer of truth, and has taken some very sharp blows over the last 20, 30, 40 years, where it's very difficult for even when the USCCB comes together on an issue and expresses positions as it pertains to Catholic social teaching to weigh in on political items, for political policy, doesn't carry a whole lot of punch that I can see.
Yeah, I think the clout that the bishops have as the USCCB, I think that's one, I think, particular manifestation of the moral sway that the church still has.
Authority.
But I think the relationship between our civic government and the church still fundamentally stays the same. And the church, I think, does have a much more powerful voice than we give it credit for within the civic realm. You mentioned that, only 20% of the populace is Catholic, but 70% of the populace is Christian. And so 70% of the populace is inclined, I would say, still even to listen to the moral reasoning, moral thinking, teachings of the Catholic Church. We have to be a little savvy as Catholics of how we deliver that. I don't think we can effectively go up and say, well, the Pope has proclaimed this, and so therefore that's how we ought to do things. That's not going to fly in American civic life.
Correct.
But the ideas, the philosophical content, the theological content of the Church's teachings are very well received by a large chunk of our Protestant brethren. And so, you know, I think the voice of the Church on a lot of these issues does carry a lot of sway, because sovereignty's changed a little bit. And so it's no longer a king that is kind of dictating public policy, but it's the populace. The nature of how the Church delivers its message and how the Church has a moral bearing on policy has changed a bit too, and it's shifted to the laity. So the laity is now the moral voice to a certain extent of the Church within America, and that's kind of good news and bad news at the same time.
Right.
You know, we lay people haven't always done a good job, and so the problem isn't so much necessarily how loud our voice is, but in a lot of ways it's how diluted our voice has become within the American public, but also how diluted the teachings of the Church has become within our own lives as we live them out as Catholics.
Well, there's some of that. I maybe a point of departure for me from that would be I think there's increasingly, though, you said, you know, that they maybe, you know, because we're predominantly a Christian country, if you will, based on people's belief systems. But here's where I start with that in terms of receptivity to the teachings of the Church. I think there's increasingly, though, a trend and maybe a prevailing trend towards leaving Church teachings behind on purpose. Because there's one, they're not well taught, they're not well understood, but also because again they're often now positioned as antithetical to the modern project as it pertains to equality. So when you think of the Church is often presented as heterodox to especially LGBT rights, and
correct,
is positioned as a lot of problematic for that. But with that, let's pause there. We'll take a short break.
Yeah, we need to take a short break right here. We'll be back with more of The Cave on Catholic Radio Indy right after this. Start your weekend off right with Catholic Radio Indy's Saturday morning lineup. Join James Littleton for Forming Faithful Families at 9, followed by the pro-life message of I Choose Life at 9:30. Then enjoy today's music with a Catholic message at 10 on Catholic Jukebox Indiana. At 11 o'clock, we'll share an hour of Catholic thought and philosophy on the Catholic Cave. And at noon, it's time to grab a bite, sit back, and enjoy some food for thought with two episodes of Faith in Action. That's the Saturday morning lineup from your source for 100% Catholic programming, Catholic Radio Indy.
It makes me feel good. It makes me a joyful person.
Through you guys and the work that God does through you, it's brought joy to the people that I'm around because I'm a different person because of you guys.
Catholic Radio Indy.
Welcome back to the Catholic Cave. We are talking today about civics, and specifically we've been talking about the idea of separation of Church and state, and you know how to a certain extent the spiritual sphere, so the realm of God's laws, the realm of spiritual practices, etc., has a certain I guess sway, has a certain moderating effect on the temporal sphere, on the governance, on our civic life, on the laws that are passed by our country. And that's always been the case. That continues to be the case in America, but it's different. And just as we were leaving for the break, you brought up the idea that even this notion that spiritual laws and spiritual ideas ought to impact on civic government at variance with the Enlightenment idea, the founding of our country, where our country came from, and that we see a clash. You brought up the LGBTQ issues and saying, well, increasingly the church is having to leave our arguments against that at the door because it leads to this idea that equality is something that
we're against,
exactly.
The church's opposition to so-called same-sex marriage is another one, where the church is portrayed as unloving or uncaring or unjust,
right?
Because standing in the way of people's rights,
right? And that's where I would go back, that the idea that a society ought to be loving, the idea that the society ought to be just in a particular way, is a very Christian idea.
The problem is how people understand what that looks like.
Even the notion of equality. If you went back to the Roman Senate and started trying to preach equality of all citizens, they would laugh at you.
Or stone you
because they had slaves,
Correct.
They certainly wouldn't see the Romans as equal to the barbarians that they were, letting into their empire and letting into their city. No way.
Right.
Romans and barbarians were going to be equal. Certainly no way that men and women were going to be construed as equal in Roman times. And, I think the idea of equality is something very unique to Christian culture and Christian civilization. But yeah, I think it has gotten, distorted, changed, to where equality no longer goes to the person, but equality now goes to acceptance of moral and immoral behavior. That if you have a standard of what is morally right and morally wrong as far as how you conduct your behavior, you're saying that certain people are unequal or not equal, or certain institutions are unequal or not equal. And that's just a misconstrual of what's meant by equality.
Right. And it goes into the broader problem, which is that, civil society has drunken deeply from the cup of relativism, and as sort of its dominant moral code and moral standards. And so the church, which is which makes truth claims that are some of which, of course, are not subject to change over time. An understanding that good and evil are real, and some things really are good and some things really are evil, and therefore by never justified, for example. This is not to the modern setting, or postmodern setting, to be more specific. Those are not welcome positions, because the predominant cultural view now tends to be one that's much more around using words like acceptance, intolerance, inclusion, diversity, all as ways of equality, all as sort of these banners from which, we're all going to be able to coexist. The bumper sticker. I finally worked it in. I've been wanting to do that for a long time. That crazy coexist bumper sticker, which is ridiculous. It's a ridiculous symbol. And I'll unpack that some other time. But or just saying, it's Kent at Catholic Radio Indy. If you want to comment on my coexist, send Kent the comments.
Any complaints need to go to Kent at Catholic.
No, it's just it strikes me as a violation of the law of non-contradiction when I see that sticker, because there are some things. It's a kind of whitewashing over some of the things that make these different religions and different belief systems really impactful are the things that are irreconcilable one right to the next. Like for us, let's say the Trinity. Well, you're not going to have that in Buddhism, okay? So, the sticker kind of just sets that all aside, in one fell swoop. I mean, I get it's about, hey, let's all get along. I'm for getting along, but I'm not forgetting. But that's not our greatest good. Our greatest good is to seek the truth.
Yeah.
Right. We need to be that needs to be our fundamental commitment.
Right. I think when you're looking at civic life and what the church teaches and what our contribution to civic life can be, we have a very fixed, very, I would say, well thought out understanding of human nature. That human beings are sinful, that human beings need certain limitations on their behavior to be able to pursue the common good. And we have an understanding of the common good that is directed. It's directed towards a very unique understanding of happiness within the Catholic world. And this is something I don't think we should give up when we're engaging in civic life. The tradition of the Catholic Church of teaching about human nature, what human nature is, how human nature has fallen, how that can be restored, and the idea that civic life is supposed to be bringing us and drawing us closer and closer towards our heavenly state, which means we have to have a notion of kind of the common good, and good being, you know, true goodness, not just economic development.
Correct.
The common good that our laws and our society and our social bearing really ought to reflect, this idea that's drawing us all towards, I think, a more enlightened, better life.
Yeah, in fact, the Church defines the common good really as the sum total of conditions of social living whereby persons are enabled more fully and readily to achieve their own perfection.
Right. So there's a notion of, first off, there's a notion of persons that, you know, I think if you broke that down and you started having a discussion about, you know, what makes us a person rather than a human being? And by that, I mean, what gives us a status and stature of moral authority, of honestly, legal authority to a certain extent, beyond just being an animal? What sets us apart
than just being a biological organism?
Right, exactly. Yeah. What sets us apart? If you had that conversation with 10 different people, you'd get 10 different answers.
Right.
But I think as Catholics, we've got to keep an eye on what the Church teaches about that and then use that to be able to argue towards laws and civic life that draw us closer and closer to the idea of perfecting that person, which is leading us all closer and closer to sainthood. So as Catholics, we need to be pursuing laws and jurisprudence that lead not only us, but everybody closer to sainthood.
Right. And you know, just to borrow for a second from the USCCB document on forming consciences for faithful citizenship, in the document it addresses a key question that maybe some listeners might have right now, which is like, you know, why get involved in politics at all? Shouldn't we just, you know, as people of faith, shouldn't we just set that aside? And the answer that you'll see in this document is, well, no, we need to get involved. The laity do need to be involved. Why? Because public policy affects the common good. We also know that there, as I mentioned, we, and you were just talking about this, Mark, we have a profound and deep, and I would say authentic and true understanding of the dignity of the human person. We also understand what subsidiarity is and need to pursue that. We have a good understanding of what the common good is. We also understand what human solidarity is all about, and that's going to lead us into what are have been identified really as the major issues that face Catholics, which are in social teaching, which is around human life, and we certainly know that. We've talked that many times, from abortion to euthanasia and everything in between. We also, though, want to promote peace and issues of peace, war, just war theory. What are the conditions for peace? How do you define peace? How do we achieve it? What about marriage and family life? What about religious freedom? What about the preferred option for the poor? And also about healthcare. These are all outlined in this document by the USCCB. Catholics have a tremendous contribution that we can make both intellectually but also through hard work,
right?
Tangible contributions to these issues.
And I think we have to realize that if we aren't contributing and making those contributions to civic life,
someone else will.
Someone else will, but also the Church won't be. That we live in the culture and country that we live in right now, we as lay people are the voice of the Church more and more, and it's less and less the clergy that are going to be listened to. It's less and less the bishops that are going to be listened to. It's we as the lay faithful engaging through our daily lives with the culture around us. That's where the voice of Christ is going to be heard and the voice of the church is going to be heard.
Well, it's certainly where the numbers are.
Certainly. And, right? You know, and that's the way our culture...
that's the,
way
and
our
that's
culture,
the benefit of being in a democracy.
Exactly. That's
right?
The way our culture and society has been set up to where it is a numbers game, yeah, by and large, of how many people you can get to agree with you or your position.
Well, I think also, too, we want to point out, too, is we, again, going back to this separation of church and state, this is why having this... So we're beginning really to paint that picture, Mark, of that there is a proper sphere for state authority, but there's also an indispensable sphere for religion, because it's the religious sphere that is the bulwark that sets boundaries or even pushes back against everything being engulfed by the state. When the state engulfs all of our public and personal lives, we call that totalitarianism.
Right.
And it has its own, but right, or secularism has its own orthodoxy. It has its own dictionary. It has its own grammar. And it also rewards those who agree and punishes those who disagree with its ideology.
Yeah, and this is exactly what Pope Benedict XVI warned us against when he talked about the dictatorship of relativism. It was that sort of takeover of everything that'll happen in the absence of religion. So we're going to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to talk a little bit more about this dictatorship of relativism and how we as Catholics ought to respond to it.
Back with more right after this on The Catholic Cave.
If it wasn't for you all, I don't know what I would do.
Catholic Radio Indy.
What an absolute blessing you are.
40 Days for Life is a campaign of peaceful prayer vigils held at the site of abortion providers throughout the world with the goal of eliminating abortion. Here in Central Indiana, the Lenten 40 Days for Life campaign will run from Ash Wednesday, February 14th, through Palm Sunday, March 25th. Would you consider making this campaign a part of your Lenten observance? Go to 40daysindy.org for more information. That's 40daysindy.org.
The Cross and the Light. Rock your faith in this spectacular musical and video surround experience. It's the ultimate story of redemption, how hate is redeemed by love and fear is conquered by hope. It's a story of common men and women just like us, from Christ's joyous entry into Jerusalem through his horrible murder and to the surprising events that occur after his death.
Coming to St. Malachy Parish in Brownsburg, February 24th and 25th. For information or tickets, call 317-852-3195.
Before the sun rises, and long after it sets, while you're waiting in traffic or winding down from your day, when you need us, we're here. Catholic Radio Indy.
Welcome back to the Catholic Cave. I'm Mark Tuttle, here with Timothy O'Donnell, Kent Blanford. We are talking about civics. We've been talking about the separation of church and state. We've been talking about our duties as Catholics to engage in civic life, what the church brings to the table as far as an understanding of human personhood, as far as an understanding of the common good, how that Catholic tradition can have a tremendous impact on civic life, and why it's incumbent on us as lay people to be the voice of the church, particularly in a democracy. You brought up a big bugaboo in this whole idea, though, Tim, earlier, and that is that the voice of the church, particularly, I would say, in the last decade or so, has been weakened.
Yes.
It's been incredibly compromised, and it's been compromised partly through the sinfulness of the church itself,
correct,
but also through the sinfulness of the culture around us. That the culture around us is less inclined to listen to the church because they have their own ideas of what they want to do, how they want to live. They have their own
ideas. Increasingly secular.
They have their own ideas of human personhood, and that's right. that human personhood is in no way fixed. That
liquid.
It's liquid, right? Exactly. We can change what we mean by humanity as we go along.
The genders.
And because we can change it, we can choose it. You know, we can choose what it means to be a human being. And we're not locked into any sort of understanding of
not
humanity.
Locked in at all.
Right, exactly.
We can torture nature to reveal its secrets.
Exactly. And so, you know, these ideas have picked up sway. You know, the movement for gay marriage, the movement for LGBTQ privileges and rights it's continuing to pick up more and more steam because people connect with the idea of equality, which that's a fundamentally Christian idea, but it's been perverted to transform equality into the realm of behavior, that to accept other people means to accept their behavior, right or wrong, whether it's good for them or bad for them, whether it's good for society or bad society. We have to be tolerant.
Well, equality has I've been thinking a lot about this, and I'm still not arrived at a good succinct way to describe what I think the culture means right now by equality, other than to say it's got two, I would say, almost opposing features to it that are held together in tension. And that is, one, that equality is seen as identical. But that's held in tension with a kind of complete autonomy.
Right. No, I think
so. There's a sameness and there's a whole radical autonomy at the same time. So in other words, in order to be equal, you and I have to have identical access to identical things, even though our situations and other things may be completely different.
Well, I think the push for equality is the same push that's always been there, and that is that push for complete and utter total autonomy, as you mentioned. You know, this idea that somehow we can make ourselves completely independent of our neighbors, independent of our families, independent of our culture and society, independent of everything around us, and make every single choice for our life, even independent of nature. We can somehow be our own little autonomous units.
Yeah.
But the irony,
free of constraint.
Exactly. But the irony of that is, to be able to do that, you have to force everybody to go along with it.
Correct. Correct. Yeah. Exactly. So, I mean, so for example, one of the more absurd manifestations of that is you have boys that are now competing in girls' sports,
right?
And winning, right? They can't be beat
because gender is not something that's fixed by nature.
Yeah, it's not an objective reality. It's one of these
conventions. And whenever people use the word convention, that's meant as a bad thing.
Yes, it is.
Unlike in times prior where conventions were good, conventions are now bad. And conventions can be good if they're in Las Vegas. That's kind of my take on it.
Right. Or downtown Indy is a great place to have a convention.
That's true too.
Yeah. But you're right. I think here's what's happened though. We can look back over even recent history. We can find there are ample examples where some, not even the majority, even a small number of people were profoundly wrong and even evil in committing injustices towards other human beings. And then those situations have been corrected or mostly corrected. And that still seems like that's the march of humanity, that there's the Catholic understanding is that we're fallen. We're sinful and we need redemption. We need a savior. Well, another vision of man, and I would say this is more of a progressive, enlightened, postmodern kind of view, is that no, human beings are immediately perfectible if only we would, you know, remove the constraints.
Right.
And that's very different from a Catholic understanding of the human person, which is, again, we're weak, we're vulnerable, we're fallen, we need redemption. We grow in virtue and holiness through a tremendous amount of effort, but more importantly, grace that's building on nature. And so you have we have an entire culture that kind of rejects, by and large, I think rejects that understanding of the human person and instead says, no, through choosing and through technology, I can fashion myself and reality to what I will.
Right. And the reality is that notion of the perfectibility of humanity by taking off all the constraints, taking off all...
And the church is a constraint in that view.
Right. Anything that would hold us back.
That's why we need to get rid of it.
Right. But that...
or ignore it.
The reality is, though, that view is gaining ascendancy. That view has been...
Completely agree.
Has been growing, and I think the speed with which it's been growing has increased.
Oh, it's accelerating,
years, by far. And so the
technology itself is accelerating it.
Right. So the big question is, what, as Catholics, how do we react to that? I think there's two competing strains of thought within the Catholic world right now. One is we need to go back and kind of reshore our influence. You know, we were talking about how ideally in our culture, the influence of Christian thought comes from the laity. And the fact of the matter is, we've kind of abdicated our role within the public sphere. We're no longer are in a position where we can speak up in the workplace. We're no longer in a position where we can speak up in civic government. Certainly can't speak up in state government or federal government.
Very difficult in all those areas.
We've completely lost our voice because we've let all of the institutions that would give us a voice erode. And so one school of thought is we need to take a step back and start to rebuild culture from a Catholic perspective, kind of from the ground up, before we can even start engaging in civics again. We need to start reforming authentically Catholic schools. We need to start reinvigorating parish life. And from there, kind of grow up, you know, and build things back up. You know, this is what is known as the Benedict option from the journalist Rod Dreher. You know, he laid this out in a great book, The Benedict Option, and it's gotten a lot of blowback. It's a very controversial book because the other side of it says, no, by no means is this a time for retreat. This isn't a time to take a step back from civic life. We need to engage as much as we can at the top. At the top levels and try to have our influence trickle down. So it's kind of a trickle down theory of morality. And, you know, if we can just get the Supreme Court to overturn Roe versus Wade, if we can just get Congress to step in and pass conscience protections and, you know, protections for liberty, then all will be well down the pike. And so, you know, I think there's a great debate going on within the Catholic world as to which of these two courses we should follow.
Yeah, that is the controversy. And the Benedict option is we should try to get him on the show at some point. I heard him speak last year at Benedictine College at their symposium on the new evangelization. And that is, so the Benedict option, as I understand, you know, it's sort of this refortification taking the form of, say, monastic life broadly understood in terms of, you know, sort of we'll have our own kind of Catholic communities that protect us from a very hostile culture and one that's getting increasingly hostile, maybe even violent. That's one approach. This staying involved in the public arena, though, is the sort of the, like you said, the counter to that. The question that, you know, I haven't made up my mind kind of where it's a kind of want to see a blend of both, maybe. The difficulty about the public square efforts that, as you rightly point out, is we've suffered some real setbacks on moral authority. And but also, so I'm not sure we have the battalions for the fight. And I'm not sure we have the, in our, as church militant, I'm not sure we have, we're well enough trained or equipped for the fight either. So I'm not sure we have the numbers or the right training or the right equipment to effectively continue to go that path.
Like I said, my counter to that is that, you know, we're still a predominantly Christian culture. You know, 70%, although it is decreasing.
Look at mass attendance, though, and everything else is
But nonetheless,
falling.
the moral civic understanding, the fundamental
that
beliefs
might just be
are
a veneer.
I don't know.
I need to disagree with you. Yeah, my parents told me I agree with you too much.
Oh, okay.
So I'm just trying to disagree.
But maybe we need to have a separate show topic coming up of how Christian really is America.
Are we
truly a Christian country? You know, when we say God bless America, is this a prayer in
or
vain
how,
or is this is this a sincere motto to a certain extent of our country?
I think that's an excellent idea.
Yeah, because we unfortunately are running out of time here for once again.
Again.
I know that the time does seem to fly when we come up with these topics.
Well, and stay tuned next week, too, because we are going to have a special guest in studio next week. We're going to keep that a surprise for now. So don't miss our next episode of The Catholic Cave.
And that is all the time we have for The Catholic Cave. For Mr. Timothy O'Donnell, for Mr. Mark Tuttle, I'm Kent Blanford. Until next time, may God bless.
The Catholic Cave is a production of Catholic Radio Indy. Replays of this program are available in podcast form at catholicradioindy.org. Comments about this program can be addressed to kent@catholicradioindy.org or by calling 317-870-8400.
Did you miss something in this show or just want to hear it again? Podcasts of this and all our other great local programs are available 24/7 at CatholicRadioIndy.org.